Julian, thank you for joining us today. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Thanks very much, Jack. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Good stuff. I've been looking forward to this one. I'm going to hit you with the big question that I ask everybody that ever attends our podcast. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
On the first of those, I'm just an ordinary guy. I guess at one level, I'm the author of a book called Think Like a Spy, which is about how to exercise influence and to build life-changing alliances. But I'm really just an ordinary guy. I was born and brought up in what was then the poorest postcode in the UK, or has been described as such, which was in inner city Birmingham. And I was very fortunate in that I met a number of people in my early life who helped me to understand how to use innate interpersonal skill sets to make my way in life, both personally and professionally. And what do I want to do with that? I'm passionate about social mobility, so my aim with the book and with everything related to it is to help as much as possible people from disadvantaged backgrounds to build social capital, the better to get on, both in their personal lives, in their academic lives, and in their professional lives.
Okay. I know that you said you're just an ordinary guy. It feels like obviously I've spoken and met with a lot of ordinary blokes in the pub. They don't kind of have those visions and kind of the skill set that you talk about. I guess obviously Think Like a Spy, we're going to get into that, but it feels like you've lived quite an extraordinary life. Talk me through that. So from Birmingham to where you ended up, how did that happen?
That's a good question. Okay, well, I started off. I mean, when I say ordinary guy, what I mean is there was nothing in my background particularly that would have marked me out for any path in life. So it wasn't that I was born to a family of soldiers. It wasn't that I was born to a family of lawyers. It wasn't that I was born to a family of clerics. There was nothing that was going to mark out the path that I was to take. So I had to determine my own path. I had to work out my own way. And there was a great deal of support in my upbringing. My parents are fantastic. They were clever. They were musical. They were focused. They did the very best for us. But we had a very difficult upbringing in, as I say, one of the most deprived parts of the UK at the time. And on top of that, there was tragedy in my early life in that my only sister, my older sister, took her own life when I was 11 years old. It was my first day actually at secondary school, my first day at school because we'd been educated at home up until that point. And as you can imagine, that was devastating. And a year later, a young lad engulfed by grief, really having no idea where to turn for support because families who suffer that sort of bereavement back in those days didn't really have a network of support to fall back on to handle this incredible loss. And I ended up walking in front of a car, fast-moving car, in an attempt to escape that grief. I'm not sure whether that amounted to suicide bid myself or if it was just a cry for help, but it was something. And the upshot of it was that I ended up in hospital. And while I was in hospital, I met this incredible, extraordinary young nurse called Mare. And Mare was an Iranian refugee who'd gone through traumatic experiences during the revolution. She'd lost her father to the revolutionaries. She'd fled Iran, Persia as it then was, with her mother and wound up in Birmingham determined to honor her father, who was a medic, he was a doctor, and she wanted to become a nurse but couldn't really speak English. She was lucky enough, partly as a result of her own endeavors, to find allies who helped her develop fluency in English and to pass the exams that she needed to end up as a nurse. And she one day said to me, "You know, Cthulhu, it's a Persian word for little one. the most important thing you'll ever have in life is good allies, and never forget that. And I never have. And from that day forth, I, inspired by her story, sought the allies, sought the mentors, sought the relationships which would get me on in life. And I was lucky enough through that to end up at Oxford University, where I read PPE, surrounded by polished products of fee-paying schools, which I certainly wasn't. And from there, went on to work in the city in a company or firm called Cazenove & Company, which was one of the last really blue-blooded stockbrokers in the early 1990s. And from there into the diplomatic service, and on from that into a fantastic career in private intelligence, working in Africa. And every step of the way, I've been fortunate to have on my side some incredible mentors, some incredible allies, who were teaching me, without me even realizing it, to think like a spy, to use a skill set that spies use day in, day out to achieve incredible results. And I realized as a result of that, that while we tend to think that what spies do is somehow superhuman, that they have access to a set of skills that is denied to the rest of us, that's just not true. The reality is that they use a set of interpersonal skills which can be learned by anybody, practiced by anybody, and perfected by anybody. And more importantly, turned to use in personal and professional settings. And that's why I ended up writing the book, Think Like a Spy, because I wanted to draw on that experience, my own life journey, as it were, and I hope to inspire young people, particularly young people who find themselves from underprivileged or disadvantaged backgrounds.
So, sorry to hear about some of the things you went through, Julian, because it sounds like you had quite a difficult childhood. It feels like there was a real sliding doors moment there, where yes. Like things happened that kind of changed your whole trajectory. I guess the people listening now will have so many questions about this story, but I guess when you first kind of sought out to find those mentors, those allies, what was the first step? And I'm sure there's experiences that you've had where that their words kind of ring true with you on a daily basis.
I'm not sure I could pinpoint what the first step was. There was a realization, driven by Mayer's comments, that I didn't naturally have that social capital which some people have. And we'll talk a little bit about what I mean by that. And that it was necessary if I was going to do the things I wanted to do, storm the bastions I wanted to storm, go to the places I wanted to go, that I'd have to find my own network, as it were. I wasn't entirely on my own. You know, my parents, as I say, were extraordinarily clever, thoughtful, imaginative people. But I wasn't able to pick up the phone and get that internship. I wasn't able to turn to my parents or uncles to get the first break. And there was, a dawning realization rather than a light bulb moment, that there's a lot of truth in that old saying that it's not what you know, it's who you know. And I came to realize that the really important aspect of that is you can determine who you know. You have some influence over that second bit of that equation. Mm. And it was a realization that people genuinely and generally want to form alliances and genuinely and generally want to be supportive. And it's just a case of identifying who you can build those alliances with. And by that, I mean collaborative endeavours rather than exploitative endeavours. And what might drive them to support a young person who's looking to get on in life. So it was, I wouldn't say it was, Mayer's comments absolutely made a difference. And of course, that's the sliding door moment. But beyond that, it was more of an iterative process.
Like Like it sounds a little bit like there's not necessarily a seat at the table, so it felt like you were like, okay, well I'll go out and I'll build my own table.
I like that. Yeah,
you've
absolutely. It really
alluded
was.
to the skill set that you've learned through from mentors throughout the years. Like I'm sure people will, what does that consist of? So if I'm somebody that wants to go out there and start building, maybe I'm a young man that wants to start building incredible relationships, how do I do that?
Okay, let me tell you a story to illustrate one of the points. And the book lays out nine separate skills. And I don't think it's worth me going through each of those separate skills in turn, because I think that would be a little turgid for your listeners. But it's definitely worth me telling you one story to give you a flavour of what I'm talking about, and we can take it from there. It was when I was. When I graduated, I was not having a great deal of success in interviews. I just couldn't really manage interviews for one reason or another. You know, I'd done quite well at building certain relationships. I got a fairly good degree. I presented, I think, quite well, and I'd sort of reinvented myself for the workplace. But for some reason, every time I got to an interview, it just didn't work. I couldn't quite break through. And at the time, I was making ends meet by doing a little bit of painting and decorating at a place where my father worked as a manager of a sort of cultural space. And there was a chap called Mr. George. And Mr. George was in many ways like me. You know, he was an unremarkable person on the surface. There was nothing particularly about him that would make you pick him out as an ally, as a mentor. But there was something about him which I couldn't quite put my finger on, and I used to turn to him a lot for advice and support. And it was one particular day, and I just had my latest rejection from a job interview, and a friend of mine and I had been out the night before celebrating his getting on to winning a place for a doctorate. So I was feeling particularly low and particularly hungover as it happened, and I went to sort out Mr. George, and I explained what was bothering me, why I was feeling so down that day. And he said, "Right, okay, your problem seems to be the interview stage." He said, "So I'm going to teach you, I'm going to ask you to remember a few things." And one was essentially, if at first you don't succeed, try again. You know, don't let any single letdown affect the way you look at the world going forward. And that was quite an important thing too. You know, that accretion of rejections can have a really negative compound effect. And he the first thing he taught me was to put that to one side. The second thing he taught me was actually remarkably simple now I think about it. He said, "What do you think is the most important question in an interview?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know really. Maybe it's the one about where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?" And he said, "No, absolutely not." He said, "The most important question in the interview is when the interviewer says to you, 'Do you have any questions for us?' And how do you answer that, Jules?" And I said, "Well, I normally say, 'No, I think we've covered everything.'" He said, "Well, that's not the right answer. The right answer is you ask them questions and you show interest in them. So that's your opportunity to do two things: to show you really want that job, and secondly, to show that you're interested in them as a person. You know, they've been talking about you for the past 45 minutes. Now they'd like to talk about them. So ask them, how did they get the job? How do they find the job? What's the best aspects of working in that company? You know, what would they recommend a young person to do when seeking to work in the same field if you're not successful in that application, in that interview?" And it was simple, but it was brilliant. And I had three interviews coming up immediately after that, and I was offered jobs by all three. I think simply because of that difference in approach. Show you want the job and be interested in the interviewer. So that was the sort of lesson which I was absorbing from some, you know, people who felt unlikely, people that you wouldn't necessarily think are there to give you the most insightful advice. And that's one of the big takeaways I'd say for anybody. Just listen to what anybody is saying to you, because you never know what kernels of value you might find in them, even from the most unlikely settings.
That's kind of a double prong that I think one of the things that people struggle with, because I'm a big believer in it. I think like we talk about, like, imagine everybody's got an invisible sign around their neck saying, make me feel important, make me feel heard, and we kind of drive that home. I guess how do you this is going to sound like such a stupid question, but how do you do that genuinely where it's not just for your own need and for your own sake?
That's a really good question, Jack, because there is a danger in everything that I'm talking about that people assume I'm being manipulative or teaching how to be manipulative. This isn't about manipulation. This is about alliance building, and alliances are collaborative, as I said before. And the way to do it is actually to force yourself to be interested in other people, because other people are quite interesting. To force yourself to find that common humanity, to search out that bit which enables you to form a connection with somebody in the space between you. I know this is where I start to sound a little bit religious, but I'm not, believe you me. I do believe in something that I call a soul, and what I mean by soul is precisely that bit that is between us, which enables us to forge connections without there being a physical connection. It's that ability to, it's like I always say about writing, it's this amazing, magical thing that I can sit at my desk and think up something completely extraordinary, different.
Oh, said that you've got a call coming in.
I'm not sure what that was. Did that interrupt the last section?
It did go from the how amazing writing is.
Okay. Do you want to start now? Will you cue me in? Sorry.
Yeah, 3, 2, 1.
So one of the things, for instance, that I think about writing is that it's an amazing experience, because I can sit at my desk and come up with extraordinary, different, original ideas, whatever. Maybe they're not so original. I can describe something that I'm looking at across the room, and I can implant that into the mind of somebody else, thousands and thousands of miles away, in different cultures and with different outlooks. And if you think about it, that's quite a magical connection. And that's what I mean by soul. It's that thing that it between that links all humans. So you asked me how one engages genuinely with other people. My answer is by recognizing the shared humanity that we all have, by recognizing that we are all in this quasi spiritual way linked, and we are all able to learn from one another. And another way of looking at it is the 6 degrees of separation. I know that's talked about quite often, but we are all ultimately linked. And a recognition of that and an embracing of that, I think, can make a really big difference to the way in which you interact with people. Because there's a commonality there which is there to be explored. And more important, perhaps even anything else I've said, is by understanding others, you can understand yourself better too, and it becomes a really positive iterative loop. So how do you become genuinely interested in people? The answer is be interested in people.
Okay, so it feels like it's with this what you're talking about, it could feel to someone that this is always going to be a thing, and people would say, well, that's just the way the world turns. I guess how are you looking forward and I guess making change? What's the plan? Do we see a future where it can be split evenly, where it is fair?
Sorry, are you asking me from a political perspective? How do I see it working out for the country or for the world? Or are you asking me from a personal perspective? Because the answers are different.
From a personal perspective, I'd like to get Julian's, like, your grip on this.
The answer to it is that it's about you summed it up very nicely a while ago. If you're not invited to the table, build your own table and then populate that dinner party with the people that matter to you and to whom you matter. So part of that is about reinventing yourself, I'm afraid, and that's where I talk about cover in the book. It's, you know, it's not about pretending to be somebody you're not. It's actually tapping into those bits of you that are part of that Rubik's Cube of personality and presenting them in a way that makes you attractive as an interlocutor, as an ally to others. I talk about in the Harry Potter movies, Sirius Black at one point says to Harry Potter, you know, we all have light and dark within us, and what distinguishes us is the way that we use those, or words to that effect. And I would go further than that and say that in all of our personalities, we have a multiplicity of traits. And we tend to have a belief that we are who we are, and it's fixed for your life. And I absolutely reject that. I refute that absolutely. I think you can change the way that you interact with the world. And that doesn't mean that you're not being genuine, because the only way that you can do it, the only way you can do that in a way that is satisfying and effective, is to be authentic to yourself. So you have to tap into that part of yourself that perhaps you haven't realized was there, or you haven't properly presented to the world. And can I tell you another story about that?
Please.
Write about in the book. So again, this is going back to my very early years. Having had the experience of going to hospital and having a very close brush with death. I mean, literally, you talked about a sliding door moment. When I landed on the other side of the road, having been hit by a vehicle, if there had been a vehicle coming in the opposite direction, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you today. So thank God that didn't happen. And what those experiences did to me, I'm afraid, to a certain extent, was to build quite a hard shell. And so, yes, at one level, I was looking around and building alliances and relationships that I thought might be helpful, if that's the right word, as I've made my way through life educationally and professionally and so on. What I wasn't very good at doing was just actually making friends. I wasn't a very nice young man, if I'm quite blunt about it. And this was illustrated quite starkly to me on one occasion when I've been doing a summer job just before going up to university and adding up marks on exam papers, as it happens. And not very challenging, but there was a group of people, other students or, you know, people waiting to become students, working with me. And we'd all go out as a group. And I was sort of on the margins of that group, tolerated rather than the centre of it. And there was one woman, one girl, I suppose, who I really, really liked, and she seemed really to like me. And we'd sit on the margins of these groups and we'd chat for ages, and we'd talk about everything from politics to upbringing to the sorts of discussions we're having now. You know, what is personality? How does it work? How do you get on in life? And one day I screwed my courage to the sticking point and asked her out, and she said no. And I was a bit blown away by that, because, you know, all the evidence I had was that she enjoyed my company and would be quite happy to spend more time with me and perhaps explore a deeper relationship. And so I asked her why not. You know, it's a fair enough question, I thought. And she said, well, because you come across as not very nice. And she said, you might be quite interesting. You are quite interesting. I like having conversations with you. I like hanging out with you, but you just don't come across as very nice. So I took that away, and as you can imagine, at that sort of age, brooded on it for a long time. And then I realised that she'd said something quite interesting in the way she put it. She said, you don't come across as very nice. And I thought, that's interesting. Does that mean that we all have it within us to be nice? So I looked around at people that I knew were, you know, decent characters, nice people. And I observed how they behaved. And then I imitated them. I drew on my observations of what they did and took their traits and personality aspects and characteristics and put them into my everyday life. And what happened was quite magical, because I thought it transformed my personality, because I think I went from being not, I thought I went from being not very nice to being very nice, or being nicer. Let's not be presumptuous. But in actual fact, all I was doing was tapping into a part of my personality that I'd hidden. And this is where I talk about personality cover. It's not quite the right phrase. It's not cover. It's just presenting yourself in a way which is probably better for society, probably better for your community, and certainly better for you. And a year later, I met this woman again, and at a party, quite coincidentally, she was with her boyfriend. She started seeing somebody at university, and at the end of the evening, her boyfriend had left because he was travelling on holiday the following day with his family. And she came over to me and she said, "You are absolutely transformed. You're not the person that you were a year ago. Would you like to go out for dinner?" And I said no, because I wasn't going to do that to her boyfriend. And the fact that I said no came from a genuinely different part of my personality than I would have been tapping into the year before. Does that make some sense? We can use what we have at our disposal for good or for bad. And it's up to us all to decide which way we're going to go.
I love that. And if you had have said yes, well then it wasn't genuine. It was a facade, which meant, do you know what I mean? Like you put an outfit on, and that wasn't the goal. It was like, how do I think that's brilliant. Like,
yeah, I think exactly. The whole point of that story is at the end, I said no, because it could, you know, by adopting the cover, if you like, in inverted commas, I could have achieved my aim. If my aim was to have a relationship with her, but actually my real aim, which I hadn't even realized at the time, was genuinely to become a better person.
Hmm. I heard something, it's like a beautiful mindset thing, and it's called like the as if effect. It's like, well, I'll just act. So what is somebody that's brave? So obviously we've got people that are on the phones every day. It's like, well, what is somebody that isn't scared of rejection? What happens if I act as if I wasn't scared of rejection?
Absolutely.
And ultimately you start to, and confidence is competence. You start to lean into that, and everything's a remix in life. We know that.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we hear the phrase fake it till you make it. I would adapt that phrase and say fake it until you become it.
Mm.
And that can apply in many different contexts. As you say, you know, if you are not the most confident person, you're still capable of walking into a room and engaging with anybody in that room. Mm. If you just do it. And I don't think that is actually faking it. I think it's, you'd be amazed, and it's taken me a long time to realize. I mean, I'm getting on a bit now, I'm 54. It took me a long time to realize that most people in a social setting are quite uncomfortable. You know, there are very few genuinely extroverted, confident people out there. And I know people in my own life who I looked at and thought, gosh, you're just a natural extrovert. You're just a natural charismatic person. And then I've caught them in unguarded moments, hyperventilating, you know, in the bathroom, trying to get their confidence back up to get back out there and put on the face that they're putting on in that social setting. And that, you know, in, at one level, it's sobering to see people who you think are just naturally capable of interacting, of being very strong in interpersonal settings, actually struggling. At another level, it's quite inspiring, because you realise if they can do that, you can too. It's all, I don't know if you remember the Mr. Ben cartoons. It's going back a very long way. It shows my age.
The many different outfits of Mr. Ben.
Absolutely. And that's what we're doing in life a lot of the time, you know. So when I talk about cover, people raise their eyebrows and think that I'm talking about lying or pretend to be something you're not. I'm not. I'm just talking about putting on that outfit in metaphorical terms that you need to put on at that time. And we can all do that. You know, I am absolutely an introvert. I really am. I you know, I have to have time alone. The only way I can recharge is through solitude. But I thought to myself for many years, given the jobs I've done in government and in the private sector, I believed I was an extrovert, and that's ridiculous. It was only when I took the Myers-Briggs personality test that I realised that I was anything but. And the greatest thing I think I ever did was recognise that and embrace being an introvert. Because in the past, I'd been inclined to think of introversion as a bad thing. But it's not. It's just a personality trait. And once you engage with your own personality, you're able to adapt it, manipulate it to a certain extent, to present yourself as you need to in any one particular point without having to be inauthentic. And I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah, you got me thinking there, that fake it till you make it. It feels like it's a fake it until you figure it out.
Yeah.
Kind of explore and go down that path. I think that's lovely. One of the things you said earlier that I kind of want to go back to, and it might come across as like imposter syndrome, but I'm actually not asking about this. It's more like feeling out of place. So socially, I can speak from my experience, like I get invited to various different events where you might feel socially, if you are trying to build those alliances, we can put the cover on, we can have the skill set, and we can have all the confidence we want, but there might just be a part of you deep down that goes, I'm not part of the Eton gang. I guess, is that something you've experienced, and how do you combat that?
In spades. My first job, as I said, was for a stockbroking firm that was reputed at the time to be the Queen's stockbroker. I'm not sure it was, but it was certainly what most people assumed. And to get a job there, you sort of had to be from an aristocratic family. You know, they had some extraordinary characters there, some really very, very interesting people, some very charismatic people, some extraordinary people from families that, you know, I could name, but I won't. And you would recognise those names. And they were to a man, and I think I can say to a man, because there were very few women working for that firm back at that time, amazingly smooth. And they could go into any social setting and perform. And I came in as a comprehensive schoolboy from inner city Birmingham, wearing an ill-fitting suit and speaking the wrong language, and I had to fit in somehow. I will come back to how I did that. But just, I talked about speaking the wrong language. Let me give you an example of that. There's one occasion when I was manning the bank of desks, people were out for lunch in the team I was working for, and somebody phoned up and wanted to leave a message for a colleague. And the message was that they were going skiing, and the message was, tell him to meet me at Val d'Isère. Now, I've never been skiing. And I had no idea what Val d'Isère was, let alone how to spell it. So I spelled it phonetically, you know, Valdisair. And I left a message for this colleague of mine, please meet so-and-so at Val d'Isère. Then I went out for lunch myself. And when I came back, there was a gaggle of people around that desk. And my colleague was passing my note around, and everybody was sort of sniggering at it. And I can understand why. You know, I was completely out of their ken. They just it wouldn't have occurred to them that somebody could come into their clique who didn't know where Val d'Isère was, and worse, didn't go to Val d'Isère every year with that social group. So I literally didn't speak their language. I certainly couldn't keep up with them when it came to, somebody once said to me, you must be from the Fisher family in the Midlands. And I'm like, well, yes, I am. But I've no idea what you mean, but I definitely am from the Fisher family in the Midlands. And it was that sort of thing. You know, I couldn't keep up with the connections. I couldn't keep up with the holidays. I couldn't keep up with where they moved as a shoal of people with a particular social background. So what could I do? I'll tell you what I didn't do, and that was pretend to be one of them. I saw people who did. And actually, I think they were some of the saddest characters. And I don't mean that in any particularly pejorative way. I mean it really by saying I felt sorry for them because they were desperately trying to be something that they weren't. And I liken it to a glass partition, you know. It wouldn't have mattered had I risen right to the top to the partnership in that firm. I'd have always been looking through a glass partition, you know, my version of the glass ceiling. So I was never going to be one of them. So there was no point in pretending to be one of them. Now, how does that square with tapping into those aspects of your personality that you need to thrive in a particular environment? It actually fits very well, because what I did was tap into those aspects of my personality, which included social vulnerability, and I let it show. You know, that's important sometimes, to let your vulnerability show. I let them know that I felt privileged and awkward to have wound up in this organisation to which I did not belong. And you know, years later, I'm invited to their annual lunch, and I go back and I engage with people there, and I still have that sense of imposter. I still have that sense of I'm not part of this, but I have great friendships from that firm 30 years on. And I think the reason I do is because I was true to myself. Yes, I perhaps massage the way in which I speak. I mean, you probably don't see much of a trace of a Birmingham accent. It's there, but I suppressed it. Perhaps I'm not so proud of that aspect. Yes, there are parts of me which perhaps I have purposely downplayed. But in the end, most importantly, I think I've always been true to who I am. And I think they respected that too.
Julian, this has been a beautiful conversation. I feel like that's the perfect note. I could talk to you all day. The stories from your book are amazing. I feel like there's so much to learn. I've taken some great takeaways. If people want to work with you, I know that you're on a big mission in life. You're doing some amazing things. If they want to read your book, where can they find you? How can they get in contact with you?
Okay, I've got an author website, which is julesfisher.com, JulesFisher.com. There are contact forms on that, and I'd be delighted to hear from anybody. I can be found on LinkedIn. And I'm just about to launch a Substack. I haven't yet posted, but it's called, well, the address is julianfisher.substack.com. And so if anybody wants to go on there and subscribe before I've even written my first post, I would, of course, be absolutely thrilled. And the other point I'd like to make here, Jack, is, and I mean this absolutely sincerely, I am very happy to give my time to come and talk to people at schools, universities even, penal institutes, whatever it might be, if I can help to generate even the smallest amount of inspiration in somebody, then to me that's worth the time, that's worth the investment of my time. So please, if anybody would like to hear me talk, I am very happy to come and do it, and just get in touch with me through the website, julesfisher.com.
Definitely. We'll put that in the comments. I guess a lasting thought, I call them shower thoughts. I was genuinely thinking about this in the shower the other day, and I was like thinking, my life has had like some mad trajectories just because of one person's book or one person's, other people have inspired me like to do a marathon or things like that. And I think like from this conversation, there will be people listening to this. And I think your story is incredibly inspiring. It's a beautiful take. So thank you, Julian.
And thank you so much for allowing me to speak so openly. And so, you know, I hope with a degree of vulnerability as well, because another thing I've learned over the years is we're all really reaching out to one another. It really doesn't matter what your background is. We're all reaching out to one another across the void. And it's incumbent on all of us. It's an obligation, I think, for all of us to demonstrate the vulnerabilities where they're there and to engage with people as equals, wherever they're from.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Julian.
And thank you, Jack.